the and the second group, as we know, are ben adam lechaverah, are interpersonal. And yet, as you know, if you go through the first list, right? So commandment number one is, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. Commandment number two is, don't have any other gods besides me. Commandment number three is not to take the name of God in vain. Commandment number four is, remember the Shabbat day to keep it holy. So far, so good. Commandment number five is, honor your father and your mother. So obviously, one of the questions is that commandment number five should technically be moved over to the second column, because generally speaking, honoring parents seems to fall into the category of the interpersonal as opposed to the Bein Adam Lamakom. But obviously, commandment number five is seen as the transition and the link between human beings and God and human beings and their fellow human beings, because the concept is, by the honor and respect that we have towards our parents, who brought us into the world, who gave us life, who gave us opportunity, we can go from there, we can extrapolate from that point, and have love of God, who did the same. So in effect, the concept is that if one does not have honor of parents, it is difficult on some level to have honor of God, because God ultimately is the super parent. God is the parent of the parent. And that's why the Gemara says in many places that kibud aviyem, honoring parents, is as great as honoring God. It is a way of honoring God for the gift of life. Again, I'm not sure exactly where we left off last time. Let's just comment. If you go on chapter 5, verse 12, the fourth commandment begins, Shamor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. Shamor, observe the Shabbat day to make it holy. Now remember, in fact we just read it this last week, this is just Moshe repeating what the commandments were in Exodus. Now the first three commandments, the wording is identical to that in Exodus. It's a word-by-word repetition. The first major deviation is introduced by the word shamar, while it says in Exodus the word zachar. So when God gave the commandment to Moses in Exodus, Shabbat was described as a day of remembrance, zachor. Here, it is described as a day of shamor. This is Moshe Rabbeinu's change or reinterpretation of it. Again, I think we may have covered this, I'll just mention it quickly in case we had covered it. Zachor, remembering Shabbat, are those aspects that connote the positive observance of Shabbat, the recitation of the Kiddush, the Havdalah, the meals of Shabbat, the days of the week, we count them to Shabbat, the first day towards Shabbat, the second day of Shabbat. One must remember Shabbat in terms of what they buy, in terms of what they prepare, the positive aspects. Shamar is more of the negative. That requires the refraining from the concept of melacha. Now, all of us know, I'm sure over the years you've learned, that the translation of melacha, the Torah says in Shabbat, do not do melacha. Melacha should not be translated as work or labor. Because from the standpoint of halacha, there's many things that are work or labor that you're allowed to do in Shabbat, and many things that aren't very hard that you're not supposed to do in Shabbat. So for example, if I'm in my house and I want to move a heavy table back and forth all day, that's a lot of work, but it's not melacha. Conversely, under the halacha, if I walk outside and there's no eruv, which is a symbolic enclosure, and there's a little, you know, paper clip in my pocket, I've done melacha because I've carried from the private domain to the public domain. Or, for example, the use of electricity in Shabbat, which again, from the standpoint of halacha, one does not turn on things because that's making a fire. Well, people say, well, in the olden days, making a fire involved rubbing two stones together. It was a lot of work. But these days, what's the big deal? But the short answer is that from the perspective of halacha, and I recognize people are at different levels of observance here, but just in terms of the classical halachic statement, melacha does not mean physical labor at all. It is nothing to do with physical work. Melacha refers to creative activities which transform the raw materials of nature, which demonstrate human mastery over the inanimate world. And on Shabbat, to demonstrate that God is the ultimate master, we refrain from that aspect of creativity which would otherwise demonstrate our mastery. And that is the difference between the word melacha and the word avodah. Avodah, eved, is fruit, physical work. The Torah does not say in Shabbat, don't do avodah. Melacha, although again, one is tempted to relate it etymologically to melech, which is king, although that's probably incorrect, because it's mem, lamed, aleph, chaf. But nevertheless, three of the letters are common to melech. It refers to mastery and control. And thus, if you go through the 39 melachot, right, the 39 melachot of Shabbat, and you go through what they involve plowing, planting, harvesting, cooking, using, moving objects from one domain to another domain, writing, erasing, building, sewing, skinning. They all involve the notion of human beings' ability to control and manipulate their external environments. And on Shabbat, we refrain from that in acknowledgement of God's sovereignty. Now that is in the word shamar. So zachar is interpreted in rabbinic tradition as the positive remembrances of Shabbat, and shamar is the negative remembrances. Now, which did God say? So as we know in the song that we sing Friday night, L'cha Dodi, that's what it means, shamar v'zachar, right? Remembering, or observing and remembering, the Dibur Echad were said in one word. Where did the poet get that? The poet got that from the fact that in Parshat Yitro, in Shemot, the fourth commandment begins with the word zachar. In Parshat V'etchanan, the fourth commandment begins with the word shamar. The rabbis could not conceive of Moshe Rabbeinu changing what God said. The answer must have been that in God's word, in a way that we don't fully understand, the Jews heard and absorbed both ideas at the same time. So if you sleep all day in Shabbat, let's assume you take yourself a sleeping pill and you sleep for 25 hours, you may have fulfilled shamar. You didn't do anything wrong. Let's say you chain yourself to your bed. Shamar, I did nothing wrong at all. But you certainly have not fulfilled zachar. The other way around, if one makes a nice Shabbat meal and a kiddush, that's important. That is a mitzvah. Even if somebody were to go to work afterwards, it's a mitzvah to do what you can. That's very important. Shabbat should never, no mitzvah should ever be viewed as an all or nothing proposition. Whatever one does is of significance, but one is only fulfilling the zachar and not the shamar. Part of Shabbat, you see, is to sensitize us and remind us that we are not in control of the world, that it is Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that is in control of the world. You know, Herman Welk writes in This Is My God that in the 1940s, when he first began writing, he was involved in a Broadway play. I don't recall what the name of the play was. Was it? Oh, that's what it was. Okay, right. It's a famous book. Okay, so he writes about the fact that they were going to open up that weekend, Sunday night or something, and they were doing these last-minute frenetic changes right before the play is going to open. It's a big Broadway play. And at, 5 o'clock, he just says, I'm sorry, I got to go home now. And they thought he was absolutely crazy. I mean, this is, they have to worry, they have to do an all-nighter. They're going to be opening up in less than 48 hours. And he thought he was crazy, too. He says, how can he do this? But on the other hand, he realized the tremendous serenity of kind of removing yourself from that weekday world and putting yourself into the world of Shabbat. I have to say that rabbis probably don't enjoy Shabbat as much as other people because this is our working day. But still, we can at least preach the idea, even if we can't always experience it. And that is the notion of the oasis time. Abraham Joshua Heschel talks about the fact that in Judaism, we have, of course, holiness of space, the temple, Jerusalem, but there is a unique idea of sanctified time, holiness of time, and the Shabbat is certainly the paradigm of that holiness of time, which carves out an oasis in a turbulent world in which one can indeed become close to God. Let me just share with you a thought. Again, I'm always afraid I'm just repeating something I said 2 weeks ago because I had talked to some other groups in between. Remind me, let me just ask you, did I talk about the Shabbat tefillot last time? Why Shabbat is feminine?
No.
I did mention that. Some people remember it. Okay, for the benefit of those who either don't remember or didn't hear it, let me just mention the idea fairly quickly. And that is, you know, the Shabbat is a unique day because each tefillah is a different middle bracha. In other words, if you take the Amidah, take the Shemona Esrei, so normally you got your first three blessings, which are praise of God, you got your last three blessings, which are thankfulness to God, and then on Shabbat, and on holiday, you have a middle blessing that talks about sanctification of the holiday. And just in terms of what, these are all given names, by the way. The first bracha of the Amidah is called the Birkat Avot. It is the blessing that involves asking God to remember the merit of our forefathers. That's Birkat Avot. The second bracha, which begins Atah Gibor, God's might and God's power, is called Gevurot. The third bracha, which talks about God's holiness, is called Kedusha, as you would expect, and indeed, the Chazan's Kedusha is recited in the middle, really, of that third bracha. All Shemona Esreis, all Amidot of the entire year, are always prefaced with Avot, Gevurot, and Kedusha. On Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, it's an expanded Kedusha, but ultimately it's all that Kedusha. How do we know that Shemona Esrei is supposed to be prefaced by Avot, Gevurot, and Kedusha? Actually, the Talmud deduces this from a psalm that we recite every Shabbat. And this is the psalm that is recited when we return the Sefer Torah, which is Psalm 29. I'm sure most people sing it. Havu Lashem, Bnei Yayim, Havu Lashem Kavod Vios, Havu Lashem Kavod Shemor. Is that what that means? What does that mean? Havu Lashem Bnei Yayim means give honor to God, you sons of the, you children of the mighty ones. And in rabbinic tradition, the mighty ones are the Avot, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who served God without reservation. So it means when you praise God, begin with mentioning the Avot. Then it says, Havu Lashem Kavod Vios. Give God glory and strength. That's Gevurot, that's Atah Gibor. Havu Lashem Kavod Shemo. Give honor to His name. That's Atah Kadosh. You are holy. V'Shimcha Kadosh. And your name is holy. So the paradigm of Avot, Gevurot, and Kedusha is actually, the rabbis relied upon the wording of Psalm 29 to determine that. And in fact, the reason the Amidah of Shabbat is seven blessings, three before, three after, and a middle one of Shabbat, is because the psalm then goes on and talks about the voice of God is on the waters, the voice of God is on the oceans. It says the word kol, voice, seven times. And that was seen to be a hint that the Shabbat prayer should have seven brachot. The gentleman.
Yeah, I was just reading that, and I've never seen this anywhere else, that the Amidah was actually created by the rabbis, the sages, for purposes of meditation. And I found it truly fascinating, but I've never seen this in any other text. And this is Aryeh Kaplan who said.
Yes, I was going to say, Aryeh Kaplan. Well, again, it's certainly a possibility. Maimonides has more of a rationalistic bent on it. Maimonides talks about the notion that true prayer should be spontaneous, but as people lost that capacity, the rabbis gave them a form to replace the inability of people to be spontaneous. That's Maimonides' kind of rational idea of the Amidah. But yes, Rabbi Kaplan does have a number of sources that also regard the Amidah as a meditative exercise. Which, of course, they're not inconsistent, meaning the same prayers can serve multiple purposes for multiple audiences.
Well, he expands it and says that when it took an hour to do a prayer of Akiva, of Rabbi Akiva, and
right.
I forgot the other one.
Right.
Something that's saved.
Yeah, well, the Mishnah mentions that the original Hasidim, and this is not the Baal Shem Tov's Hasidim, these are Hasidim in the time, pious people, in the time of the temple, they would take 3 hours for each prayer.
Mm-hmm.
They would prepare themselves for an hour, they would pray for an hour, and then they would decompress themselves for an hour. So that's a total of 9 hours a day spent in prayer. So that's very, very unique. But be as it may, The Shabbat Amidah is very unique because for every other holiday, you got the first three blessings and the last three blessings. What are the last three blessings? We'd say is Avodah, asking God for the temple service, and then Hoda'ah, thanking God, and the last one is Shalom, the blessing for peace. So Avot, Kevurot, Kedushot, Avodah, Hoda'ah, Shalom, and in the middle, on Shabbat and Yom Tov, you have a bracha that talks about the holiness and specialness of the day. Now that is the common pattern for Shabbat and Yom Tov. But the difference between Shabbat and Yom Tov is that on every holiday other than Shabbat, the middle bracha is invariably the same, whether it's Maariv, whether it's the evening, the morning, or the afternoon. That middle bracha is the identical wording. Shabbat is the only one that breaks the pattern, because the middle bracha for Shabbat in the evening is different than the middle bracha for Shabbat in the morning, and that's different than Mincha. In other words, each one has a unique theme. For example, Friday night, the theme is creation. God created the world in 6 days. Celebrating Shabbat as the anniversary of God's completion of creation. In the morning, we talk about Moshe bringing down the two tablets of stone. In other words, it commemorates Matan Torah, which, by the way, also occurred on Shabbat. At Mincha, we are actually talking about the ultimate Messianic Shabbat, because we talk about you are one, God is one, we hope to be one, we're not there yet, certainly, and we talk about the ultimate unity and the ultimate peace, meaning it looks towards Messianic aspirations. So you see the pattern here. You have Shabbat of creation, Shabbat of revelation, Shabbat of redemption. Creation, revelation, redemption. It parallels, actually, I don't know if Rosenzweig based his style of redemption on the Shabbat service, but these three stages parallel almost exactly Rosenzweig's structure in the style of redemption, creation, revelation, redemption. And this represents the metamorphosis we go through on every Shabbat, where we feel recreated, we submit to God's will, and we ultimately aspire to a redemption of ourselves and the entire world. Which again, the paradox is, you are only redeemed when Shabbat is over. You're not redeemed during Shabbat. You're going through this birthing process. In effect, this requires both the Zachar and the Shamar, because it requires both an acknowledgement of our limitations, which is Shamar, we're not the bosses, but it also reminds us that we have to celebrate the relationship we have with God through the Zachor. And in fact, even refraining from Malacha has two. One is to remind me that I'm not the boss, I don't run the world, but the other is equally important, the world doesn't run me. You see, when you don't answer the phone, let's say, you're really making two statements. You're saying, I'm not in charge here, but you also say, and they're not in charge here, meaning one, as it were, does not become a slave to the demands of the world. That's also important. So, ironically, the submission to God's rule is also a declaration of independence from the pressures and demands that the rest of the world can make on you. And that is why, well, again, let me just point out that there are two fundamental differences between the fourth commandment in Yitzhak and the fourth commandment in Vietchanan. There are two separate differences. One difference we just pointed out, Yitzhak talks about Zachar, remembering Shabbat in a positive sense. Vietchanan talks about Shamar, refraining from the Malachot. That's one difference. But there's also another difference, and that is the reason for Shabbat is a different reason. All of us know that in Exodus, the reason that's given for Shabbat is the very famous reason, because God made the world in 6 days, and on the seventh day, God rested. Right? If you ask anybody, why do we keep Shabbat? That is what the fourth commandment says in Exodus. But what does the fourth commandment say here? Look down a little bit in verse 15. An amazing thing, which almost appears to be a non sequitur. Chapter 5, verse 15. V'zacharta, you shall remember. Ki eved hayita be'eretz Mitzrayim. You were a slave in the land of Egypt. Vayotziyacha Hashem Elokecha misham, and God took you out of there. Biyad chazaka, with a strong hand. Ubizrela nituya, and an outstretched arm. Okay, therefore, Sivcha Hashem Elokecha, God has commanded you, La'asot et Yom HaShabbat, to observe Shabbat. This is amazing. What this says is, why do Jews keep Shabbat? To remember that God took us out of Egypt. So first of all, one might ask a very simple question. How does keeping Shabbat remind me that God took me out of Egypt? What's the connection? Now in Exodus, it gives the other reason that is more familiar to us, that we keep Shabbat to commemorate that God rested on Shabbat. But how does keeping Shabbat remind me that God took me out of Egypt? The answer is, that's exactly the point. God took you out of Egypt. You're not a slave. You're a free person. And Shabbat is the day, except for rabbis again, and again perhaps for housewives as well, Shabbat is the day that we remind ourselves that we are free. Okay? So the two reasons are very complementary to each other. On one hand, Yitro reminds us of submission to God, and Vyatchanan reminds us of the inner freedom we have and the ability to just say no, as it were, to all of the demands that the world makes. So two different reasons for Shabbat. One is Briyat HaOlam, one is Briyat HaOlam, and one is Yitziat Mitzrayim. But they connote two different dimensions. One is the notion that God is in charge and not I, and the other is the notion the world is not my boss. I am independent from the world. Yes, Shana.
Do you think there's a distinction that's happening between cause and effect?
That's right, that's right.
future
redemption, the future Shabbat, right.
So where is the Kabbalistic source for the idea that through Mincha it was heaven?
Well, the Zohar, of course, the Bible of Kabbalah, describes the Zman of Suda Shlishit, the third meal, as twilight, as a time of Rava Derabin, which is Aramaic for the time of God's innermost desire to become close to us. And therefore, there's a special, that's why you should know, these Suda Shlishit, which, by the way, the Talmud already says that on Shabbat you're supposed to have three meals. That's already a rabbinic tradition. But the concept of the communal Suda Shlishit is actually post-Talmudic. It is one of the innovations of the Baal Shem Tov, that as the founder of Chassidut, one of the practices he instituted. Of course, don't tell the Mitnagdim who also have Suda Shlishit, but it was the Baal Shem Tov's idea of a communal Suda Shlishit. Of course, in the Baal Shem Tov's context, women were not involved. That happens to be true, and indeed one can raise issues. In fact, this is a real issue sometimes that people have to grapple with. In other words, if, for example, a communal Suda Shlishit in the synagogue are just kind of men only, which is sometimes the case, is it more important to spend the time with your family, or more important to attend the communal Suda Shlishit? That is a question that people have to decide. In our show, for example, women are welcome for Suda Shlishit, so many women do come, but in a lot of shows it's kind of an all-men type of thing. But be it as it may, the special magic of Suda Shlishit, the Baal Shem Tov identified as coming from the point that as the Shabbat leaves, that desire to come closer to us is much, much stronger. And therefore it's a time where you can tap into that special connection with God. And if you even look at the rituals for Suda Shlishit, there are certain songs that are sung, for example, the 23rd Psalm, which is "The Lord is my shepherd," the famous 23rd Psalm, that is customarily sung in various plaintive tunes during the third meal. There's Yedid Nefesh, which is really a love song to God. It talks about God as my beloved. Some sing it Friday before Shabbat, which is a more modern custom actually, but it was really written for Suda Shlishit. which is the time of yearning. And you did nefesh is a love song to God. If you just look at the, it addresses God in openly romantic, romantic terms. Yeah.
Would you explain, please, the notion that I've heard that closer to the Jewish people were to Sinai and the revelation experience, the holier they were. And so the further generation are away, you know, the more you have to do. Because there's a part of that that I understand, being there for the experience of revelation, accepting that, being close to that. But there's another part of it that doesn't make sense to me, since the people struggled for so many years with worshiping, you know, other gods. They didn't accept it all at once
Well, one of the things you see is that, you know, people often say, if only God would show us miracles, we would all be believers. You know, part of the answer is we have a Torah where God showed him plenty of miracles, and the person can still struggle, meaning there are no guarantees in life, and that's one of the important lessons of the Torah. Well, we do believe, though, that the closer one was to the revelation, the more one possessed truth, and things diminish. Now, occasionally, the thesis is advanced, which is really borrowed, I think, from a metaphor of Sir Isaac Newton, that even if later generations are inferior, that they could be compared to midgets standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, a midget that stands on the shoulder of a giant can see further than the giants. So occasionally the thesis is advanced that in some areas we are entitled, as it were, to build on the perceptions of the past, etc., and that's discussed sometimes. But we do say, the phrase that is used is, Nitkatnu hadorot, the generations become diminished as we go by. But ironically, what that means is not that we have to do more, but it means we can get away with less. What it means is people say that as a generation gets spiritually weaker, God appreciates the mitzvot that they do even more. Meaning to say that if in a generation of such assimilation people keep Shabbat even a little bit, it counts for much more than in a generation of the shtetl where everybody was observant and was that way. So it's really the other way. God judges us based on the environment that we live in.
But is the nexus of the explanation that supposed you were to being there, just by virtue of being there, that's what gives you that status?
Well, keep in mind that we're not making the claim that every single person then is better than every single person now. It primarily is a claim regarding the religious leaderships. In other words, Moshe was greater than Maimonides. Maimonides is greater than, you know, Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim is greater than rabbis today. Certainly, in those days, you had bad people too. You had Korach. You had Datan and Aviram, right? We're not making the claim that they were such wonderful people. Although it's interesting, I mentioned Datan and Aviram and Korach were the proverbial bad guys in the desert story. They couldn't have been that bad, because there's a rabbinic tradition that 80% of the Jews died in the plague of darkness. In other words, the only Jews who left Egypt were 20%. Now, if Datan and Aviram, the great troublemakers, left, they made the cut. They were better than 4/5 of the population. So, you see, they must have been pretty good. And in fact, you know what the Medrash says about Datan and Aviram? What were their great merits? They were taskmasters. And when they were ordered by Pyro to impose certain quotas on their fellow Jews, they refused to do so, and they actually took beatings. They took beatings instead of imposing certain punishments on their fellow slaves. And because of that, there was a tremendous merit that they had. How do we know? Well, again, it's a midrash. The midrash says, it says in Parshat V'Shalach, when they left, it says, V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael. Now, the word chamushim, it's a difficult word to translate. One of the translations is they left armed, well-stocked. But the other interpretation is chamushim comes from chamesh. Chamushim, only a fifth left Egypt. And there's even a midrash that says chamushim can be read chamishim. Only a 50th left. Now, think about the huge numbers if you take these midrashim, literally at least. There were 603,000 men above the age of 20, and we're not given the numbers of the women and the children, but it's usually estimated that you're probably dealing with a population of around 3 million. And if the 3 million was considered to be only one-fifth, then you actually had a Jewish population of 15 million in Egypt. And if it was one-fiftieth, then you're talking about 150 million, which is very, very hard actually to believe. And that's the span of 210 years, which started with a nucleus of 70. Okay, so you have to check the demographics there, but for a population of 70 to turn into 3 million at least, and then you have the various threshold of 15 million or 150 million, you have to trace the rapid growth. What the Torah says, there was a very, very large population growth. But you know, look at Australia and the rabbits. You know, what happened there? You had two rabbits, and over 50 years, there were, you know, hundreds of millions of rabbits. Yeah, we have to wonder what happened to the four-fifths. And
what justifies them being punished?
They didn't.
What was the reason?
They decided not to leave. They were afraid to kill the sheep and put the blood on the doorpost.
We don't know. One possibility is they didn't want to participate in the Pesach ritual. They were afraid, just as in the United States. There were British subjects who were Tories. They didn't want to rebel. Another possibility is, it's not that they were punished, but maybe a large number of Jews became totally assimilated, intermarried into Egyptian culture. In other words, they may not have even have known they were Jews. You know, we talk about the vanishing American Jew today, when one out of two marriages in many parts of the country is to a non-Jew, etc. And often there's no Jewish continuity after that point. So it could very well be that in Egypt we face the same situation. That on one hand, Jews were slaves, but on the other hand, there may have been Jews who managed to escape that stigma and incorporate into the larger society. So it may very well be that the 80% simply did not even identify themselves as Jews, and that might even be the metaphorical expression of dying in the 3 days of darkness. It might just mean darkness might be a symbol for ignorance and assimilation. It might refer to that as opposed to some type of punishment or wrath of God. Yeah.
Did you see on Sunday's Time the one-page ad that was speaking out?
I did not.
There was a one-page ad by a coalition of Orthodox rabbis, and the central message was religious pluralism hasn't worked in the U.S., and the way they demonstrated that was to have a two-stick figure assimilated in what it yielded in terms of children, Jews of three generations that have a person, and then if they're Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox.
Yeah.
For the example was for two Orthodox people, But the point I was just thinking of is it would be interesting to work from that model backwards, figure out if our current Jewish population, if what we're really looking at is four-fifths either being assimilated or so forth, kind of saying, okay, this is what happened in Egypt, knowing demographically what happens here in the U.S., and ultimately we're bound to, over the period of 200 years, lose
the it's a very scary thing. I mean, it really is, with no offense to people who do it, and again, I can't necessarily blame people who at the age of 25 or so have never met a Jewish person and they intermarry. But the point is, it really is a silent Holocaust, and I will use the word Holocaust to describe the decimation of Jews. I mean, Hitler did not succeed, but sometimes we could do it to ourselves, and it's a very, very difficult and tragic situation. And because, without even addressing the halakha, of course, condemns intermarriage unequivocally, but it is a well-known phenomenon that an intermarried couple, there will not be Jewish continuity beyond at most the third generation, meaning there is virtually no evidence at all of any intermarriage producing grandchildren who identified themselves in any way as Jewish. So it's a difficult situation.
The idea that the Greeks
have diminishing holiness,
this is the last time
that
Jews
teach twice. Yeah, so there are two approaches to that. One approach is that God looks at cumulative merit. So let's assume that the world needs to achieve, you know, 50 gallons of merit, to use a metaphor, before God comes. So we don't have to put in all 50, meaning to say the earlier generations may have put in 49 and a half, we just got to fill it, we got to just top off the tank. That's one way of looking at it. Or if not, if Breslov uses a military metaphor, if you have a very strong wall that needs to be broken down, once all of the armies have, you know, knocked against that wall for hundreds of years, it takes comparatively less to knock it down at the end. And the other idea is the point I mentioned earlier, that when you have a generation which is not spiritually strong, God, as it were, gives more credit. It's like a handicap in mitzvot, meaning Shabbat counts more when you're spiritually weak than it might when you're spiritually strong. And therefore, the same mitzvah that a weaker generation does counts for much more than it would in a stronger generation. So the point I wanted to point out, though, is that in the fourth commandment in particular, we see two important additions or changes over Yitro. One is the Zachar and the Shamar, and the other is the connection Shabbat to creation is in Yitro, and Shabbat to Yitziat Mitzrayim is in the Etchanan. And that explains why, you know, you probably say this all the time, but never thought of it. Why do you say Kiddush Friday night? You talk about, you know, God sanctified the Shabbat, and then all of a sudden it says, Zecher Yitziat Mitzrayim, as a commemoration of Yitziat Mitzrayim. Did you ever think? How's Friday night? A commemoration of the Exodus. Pesach night, I understand. Or right, Friday night? The answer is, of course, the text of the Kiddush is based directly on the Etchanan. And as we say, Shabbat is a declaration of freedom. It's an emancipation proclamation. And therefore, you, in effect, are remembering the Exodus when you declare you are free from the pressures of your week. Now, free to do what? Relaxing is a legitimate thing in Shabbat. In fact, one of the Zmirot talks about the mitzvah of taking an extra sleep on Shabbat, sleeping, etc. Even Shabbat is said to be an acronym. Shina bis Shabbat ta'anug. Sleeping on Shabbat is a delight. But ultimately, Shabbat should not exclusively be about sleeping or even eating or drinking, but it should be a day in which we try to reflect, we try to draw closer to our families. In fact, Shabbat sociologically is an amazing invention because it forces people to eat together. Right? You gotta sit with your family. You can't say, I have to go to this thing or that thing or that thing, or I have a meeting. There should be no meetings at Shabbat. And therefore, ultimately, we become closer to those we care about. We try to understand ourselves a little bit more. And we spend time in Torah and Tefillah, learning of Torah and prayer. And in fact, I once read by a statement by a prominent Reform rabbi who once said that the way he thinks about Shabbat is he happens not to think about it in terms of sin, that's not his orientation, but he looks at Shabbat as a missed opportunity, that a Shabbat that was not kept is kind of just something that was lost and he won't be able to recapture it. And in points, his observation is exactly right, because the very word for sin, which is chet, really means missing the mark, missing the opportunity. That is what chet is. It's not sin with whatever connotation that has, but it's just, it is the sadness at a missed opportunity that one has. So it's really one of primary importance. What did Achat Ha'am, the famous Zionist thinker, the famous statement that he made, that more than the Jews have kept the Shabbats, the Shabbat has kept the Jews, and that's a very, very true statement in many, many ways. Okay, so that's number. It's interesting. A congregant once went up to Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, a very prominent rabbi in Atlanta. He's now retired, and he kind of gave him the line about, "Well, you know, I'm a very good Jew because I keep all the Ten Commandments. That's what I do, and I don't keep the other stuff, but I do keep the Ten Commandments." So Rabbi Feldman looked at her and said, well, the fourth commandment talks about keeping Shabbat. Do you do that? So she looks at him and says, are you sure about that? You know, when people think Ten Commandments, they think, you know, don't kill, don't steal. But that's only five. You got the other ones to worry about too. Commandment number five. We as parents love to bring out to our children, just as we as children, I'm sure, had this quoted to us by our parents, and that is honor kaved et avicha ve'et imecha, honor your father and your mother. Now this is the same as in Yitro. The operative verb here is kaved, honor. However, the mitzvah is given not in the Ten Commandments, but the mitzvah in Leviticus chapter 19 is given with a different verb, yirah, fear or reverence. So these are two important aspects of this mitzvah. There is kavod, honor, and there is yirah, which I prefer to translate as reverence and respect rather than fear. The concept is not fear, but one of reverence. What is the difference between kavod and yirah? The Talmud, now again, just to be sure you understand this, this is not the difference between Yitro and Vetchanan. In both it says kaved, but in Leviticus it says yirah, fear. Ish imo v'aviv tira'u. The Talmud says, kavod refers to things like giving your parents food, in other words, serving them, spending time with them, walking with them, etc., which we would normally identify as acts of love. Although not the emotion of love. Remember, the Torah does not command you, thou shalt love thy parents. I'll discuss that in a moment. But kavod means you do acts of homage. Yirah is more of the negative. And this is something that we actually don't follow that much today. There are halachot, for example, you don't sit in your parents' seat. If your father or mother have a chair, and this is even if you're an adult, you don't sit in their chair unless they give you permission. You don't contradict them openly. You stand up, and again, according to strict halakha, again, one stands up when parents enter the room. Again, a parent can waive that. A parent can say, you know, you don't have to do that. But this is a concept of morah. Now, it's very interesting that the Torah does not say love your parents, because love is an emotion. And the Torah understands that sometimes there may be such difficult experiences in interactions that it's difficult to summon up the emotion. But the Torah says, no matter how you feel about your parents, you must behave a certain way. So kibud av v'aim is a behavioral commandment. It is not an emotive commandment. And in effect, that kind of tells you two things. Number one, your feelings might be legitimate and you don't have to destroy them. But number two, anything is expected to rise above the anger and the resentment and the hurts, and to behave in an appropriate way, even when the emotion is not necessarily forthcoming. Now, how that plays out when you're dealing with truly tragic situations, such as, let's say, an actual abusive parent. I don't mean just abusive, you know, somebody who yelled, but let's assume, God forbid, there was sexual abuse. So what do we tell the victim of sexual abuse? That, you know, you must honor and revere the person that did that to you. Well, in a strange way, the answer is yes. Now, certainly, the Torah does not compel interaction with someone that is destructive. The Torah may very well say, get away, don't talk, never see them again. But you don't get up in the middle of the street and start swearing at them and saying how hateful they are. Because the one thing that all parents have given their children without exception is they've given them life. And even if they messed everything up after that point, the concept is life is the basis of all opportunity. And therefore one needs to be grateful for those who gave them life, even if because of the poisonous dimension of the relationship, you may have to avoid contact. In fact, halakha recognizes that there may be needs to avoid or curtail contact. But halakha, by and large, does not justify any type of aggressive, disrespectful behavior. The Talmud says, for example, if my parent goes into my house, starts breaking my furniture and throwing things into the ocean, I am allowed to sue them and take them to courts and get damages. I can do that. But I'm not supposed to yell at them or push them or hit them or the like. Right? So these are certain ways in which you kind of have to divorce the anger and the hurt from what is considered to be appropriate behavior. And this is one of the mitzvot where the Torah says, if you honor your father and mother, God will give you arichut yamim. God will give you a long life. Now, if you recall, This actually raised some very interesting theological questions. There are only two mitzvot in the Torah where the Torah says specifically, if you do these mitzvot, you will have a long life. One is honoring parents, and the other, and remember which mitzvah, the other mitzvah, you get a long life. Shiluach HaKan. Shiluach HaKan is one of those mitzvot that we don't do that often. This is a mitzvah that if there's a bird sitting on a nest of its newly hatched birds, and you want to take the young, you must send away the mother before you take the young. This is called shiluach, sending away the mother that is hovering over the nest. And it says if you do that mitzvah, in fact there are people who climb trees looking for this mitzvah to do. Shiluach ha-kan. Kuf, final nun. Kan is a bird's nest. Shiluach ha-kan, yeah. It's actually shiluach ha-kan, because kan is the construct. Kane shell, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's traditionally pronounced Khan, but you're correct. It's Shiluach HaKein is the proper way of pronouncing it. Yeah. Well, God does. I was very deliberate. I didn't say that God never commands emotion. God commands emotions in many places. God commands love God. God says love your fellow Jew. But it's interesting. God couldn't command love your parent. Apparently, that command, there's just too much personal static sometimes. And therefore, God's point is, okay, I'm not going to tell you what to feel, but I'm going to tell you how to act. Now, of course, as we know, one of the cornerstones of Jewish religious psychology is how we act ultimately influences how we feel as well. In fact, the whole idea of na'aseh v'nishma, the Jews said, we will do and we will understand, is understood by classical commentary to mean the idea that it is the behaviors that ultimately influence our personalities, as opposed to the actions being the outgrowth. In other words, of course, this is really a vital insight for any type of relationship. This is true for marriage as well. There is what marriage therapists call the as-if response. Behave as if you had this feeling. Behave as if things were going okay. Behave as if you respected your spouse, even if maybe you don't for that moment. And ironically, as it were, people, except in rare cases, respond in kind. If somebody is made to feel, you know, important, significance, lovable, then people will often become that. Not always, but it's a fairly safe investment, as it were. And at least you could look yourself in the mirror and say, I behaved right, even if there was no reciprocity. So Kippur at the end, the Torah is taking the same tack. The emphasis is always not on how you feel, but how you have to act. And you act, you say that? That's right. And that is a cornerstone of how Judaism works. Because Judaism is so behavior oriented.
But the reward here is different than the reward in Shemot. Shemot is that you honor your father and mother, you will be able to stay on the land. And here it is.
Yes, I'll go over that because I actually didn't finish my point. In other words, there are these two mitzvot which we have long life: honoring parents, sending away the bird. But if you remember the one story of the heretic in the Talmud, Elisha ben Avriya.
Yeah.
Elisha ben Avriya, who's called Acher, the other one, we don't even refer to him by name. Elisha ben Avriya actually became a heretic because he saw something which to his mind disproved the truth of this assertion. He saw a young boy climb up on a tree at his father's request to fetch the young birds and send away the mother. The child fell off the tree, broke his skull, and died. So Elisha ben Avriya couldn't understand this. There are only two commandments in the Torah which if you do them, you get a long life: honoring parents and shiluach hakein. And here's a child who did both, and the child dies. So Elisha ben Avriya concluded from that the whole Torah is a bunch of lies. In other words, somebody made it up. God himself does not believe in this stuff. Maybe there is no God. It's not clear exactly what his rebellion was. And this is what turned him off from the way of the Torah. Now, he was a very great scholar. Of course, the Midrash likes to say truth of the matter is, even when he was a great scholar, he had certain bad traits. Like they say, he always had it in him, and it goes through some things. You know, it goes through some early childhood stage. But the simple meaning was, he was a very great scholar. And in fact, it's very interesting that the great rabbi, Rabbi Meir, remember Rabbi Meir was also married to Brura, a very learned woman. The great Rabbi Meir continued to study from Elisha ben Avruya even after he became a heretic. And when the rabbis criticized him, why are you hanging around that person who doesn't believe in the Torah? So Rabbi Meir gave the famous mashal that I regard my teacher as a pomegranate where I throw away the peel and I eat the good seeds, meaning I can separate the wheat from the chaff, the peel from the fruit. And people make this argument today, is it proper to study Torah from non-believers? I mean, you can have in the world people who don't believe in God, but who are very learned, very erudite, who have a lot of knowledge. So the discussion sometimes is raised, is it proper to study religious texts from people who don't subscribe to the religious value system that the texts represent? So people like to say, well, I'll like Acher. So the answer that's sometimes given is, okay, if you're like Rabbi Meir, you can learn from Acher too. But, you know, they require a certain higher level.
But,
well, I don't know if he changed. What are you referring to? How did he change? Well, Acher was a very tortured figure. It's very clear that Acher was not comfortable with his rebellion against God. In fact, number one, the Gemara has some very complicated how Acher was riding a white horse on Yom Kippur eating a sandwich, and Rav Meir was running after him asking him questions in Torah. And Acher was riding the horse eating the sandwich, and he's answering all the questions in Torah. But when they got a certain distance, because you know on Shabbat and Yom Kippur you're not supposed to go more than 2,000 cubits from the end of the city. If you have continuous buildings, that's okay, but no, it's the country. So Acher told him, you can't go any further, you have to stop. You know, this is where... So it was as if he was still protective of Rabbi Meir's religious beliefs, although Acher did not share. And then Rabbi Meir finally called out to his teacher, why don't you do tshuva? It's Yom Kippur, do tshuva, and everything will be fine. So Acher said, I'm sorry, I heard a voice in heaven that says, Shuvu banim shavavim, return my wayward children, this is God's call, chutz me'acher, except for him. So he heard that, chutz me'acher, except for Acher. I heard God say, everybody can return except for me. Now, what do you make of that? Well, the simple meaning is, this is his own voice, meaning to say, it's not God's voice. But he was so convinced that he had wandered so far that he felt he had gone beyond the point of no return. It's a tragic story because here you have somebody, you know, it's one thing if one becomes a heretic because he genuinely, you know, believes there's no God, there's no Torah, that's one thing. He could be happy about that, even if he's wrong. But you see that Acher did come to a realization that he had lived his life the wrong way, but he felt powerless to make a change. And that's a real tragedy when a person feels there's no hope for them. Yeah.
I don't know the story that you're talking about, so I can't speak from that, but it seems to me that in that kind of situation, the community can help to make that person feel differently about his place and help to bring him back.
Yeah.
So if there isn't extreme, in other words, you said he was claimed to be a heretic, which meant the community must have expelled him and given him a message. So if polarization from that point of view can work against cohesiveness and helping it not make it a hess, as you say, but a lost opportunity.
Yeah, well, you know, you're very right. Acher was somewhat of an unusual case, though, because he was not just an average person. He was a leader. He was a tzaddik. But yeah, as you know, I mean, Spinoza, many people assume that Spinoza's excommunication was a major factor in his essentially leaving the observance of Judaism. Even today, you know, people often, you know, in Europe, when there was an intermarriage, the standard custom in Eastern Europe was that the family regarded the child as dead and they would sit shiva for the child. Some people still do that, but by and large, even very many traditional rabbis do not urge that approach because they say that it's very important to outreach the child, make them feel connected, make them still feel part of the Jewish community, because that way there could be hope of somehow keeping them in the fold. Now, how far do you go with that? What about, you know, on one hand, certainly halakha could not validate the intermarriage itself, so there's a very, very difficult balance there. But people do counsel not against the notion of sitting shiva and just cutting off all contact. So you have a point there. So what's the answer? So what's the answer of Acher's dilemma? Well, the one answer is that when we talk about arichut yamim, length of days, it might refer to olam haba. Right? That's the simple answer. In other words, whenever you have a problem when the Torah says you get this reward, you can always posit it refers to the world to come. And even though, now you might say, that doesn't make sense, because it says in both Yitzhak and here, on the land that God gives you. Well, once again, one can metaphorically, Maimonides writes that metaphorically, Adama and Eretz can be used to refer to Olam Haba as well. Okay, that's one answer. But I would suggest perhaps a different answer. And that is, I don't know if this is borne out by the biblical text, but the phrase for long life that is used both here and in Yitro is Arichut Yamim. Now, Arichut Yamim literally means length of days. It does not mean length of years. Arichut Shanim, or Chayim Ayuchim, would be long life. Arichut Shanim would be length of years. Rabba Yamim, yeah. But it could be Arichut Yamim is a different idea. It's not so much you'll have a long life, but you will have a long day, meaning every day will be lived to its fullness. Meaning, a person could die young, but they could have Arichut Yamim, every day was filled. And in that sense, the concept is the following. If one honors parents, it's because you're grateful for life. You cherish life. Because what are you honoring parents for? They gave me life. If one cherishes and appreciates life, they have a mindset where despite their difficulties, they will make every moment of their life count. So it's a very logical, so it's not just a religious blessing, so to speak, but it says the attitude of a person that is an honor, one who honors and respects parents, is one who appreciates the gifts of life. And when you appreciate the gifts of life, your existence will be one, not of Arichut Shanim necessarily, but Arichut Yamim. Every day will be long in the sense of filled with meaning and purpose.
It might be a simplistic interpretation, but it also occurs to me that this little boy has had a long life. Thousands of years later, still discussing.
Well, that's a very fascinating thought. In a sense, that child gets his eternity by the fact that he is such an object lesson in the service of God and in terms of, well, that's an interesting point. That's right.
But it's not a comfort to a parent.
No, it's not a comfort to a parent. So we're not suggesting that. But, you know, people achieve their purpose in many, many ways. I had my own family. My brother had a little boy that died of leukemia around 10 years ago, a very tragic situation. But, you know, when there are these tragedies in communities, you know, you have hundreds of people get together, they pray, they do mitzvot, they make meals, they give charity. So you talk about, you know, what does a two-year-old accomplish? What has a two-year-old accomplished in 2 years? And that neshama can go to heaven and say, you know, I have transformed hundreds and hundreds of people. So it's a very good point that the meaning of our lives is sometimes in less obvious ways. It's not necessarily the job we had, and it's not necessarily the things we accomplished, but sometimes the way we transform the lives of other people. And there are ripple effects that continue after us. So for example, if you positively influenced one person to be a more religious Jew, and that person influenced other people, so it all kind of goes back. In fact, that's the concept of why we say that on a yard site or the anniversary of a death, so every person is rejudged again. Now the question is, once you're dead, how can you be rejudged? I mean, everything you did is finished. The answer is everything you did is not finished, because there's constant ripple effects that need to be reevaluated. Unfortunately, that can work for the negative as well as the positive. Because, like the little pebble you throw into a pond, right? The ripples keep on going outward and outward and outward and outward. And therefore, you have a good point, that the fact that we study about this boy is something that goes to the neshama of that child to this very day.
Really, the state of mind, and the first couple gives you a certain state of mind. That's how you live your life. That the life that you live is fuller life.
Yes.
Less so if you're talking about the state of life, you can't take it literally. You know, that this is
exactly
going to follow. I don't think
anything. Well, empirically, it's not true. I mean, there are people who die young, who honor their parents.
So I'm saying you can't take a literally.
Right. I understand.
What I'm saying is that if quality is in your own life a vote, that the chances are your life will be a happier life,
mm-hmm.
no matter how long.
Right. So again, so arichut yamin is not quantity.
It's not a literal.
Right.
But
the day will be filled with more meaning, more satisfaction. Right.
And the same thing with your ill.
Mm-hmm.
Your ill, the quality of your mind is such that you can't help yourself, you can help yourself feel better, get better,
yeah.
whatever. And that's still goes into the whole idea. You might not live a
longer
life, but
mm-hmm.
you're ill, but the chances are that whatever time you
have
left
yeah.
will be a better.
That's right. So, long life is not the end all in and of itself. I had a. Yeah, well, I did. That's very interesting. You know, this was it was surprising that elderly people who have a bad health actually did prefer to live a little bit longer in lesser health. But you know, I have to say the survey is a little misleading because it obviously depends on degrees of impairment. I mean,
that's right. But they said they claim yeah. people are
adjusted
to the illnesses, but that's not.
Well, you know, the truth is, I heard this once. You know, I heard from a very eminent physician. That sometimes when people are 35 years old and very healthy, and they see, you know, 80 or 90 year old people who are decrepit, and they say to themselves, if I have to live like that, I'd rather be dead. But by the time they're 80 or 90, that's not so bad. There is a concept of mental adjustment as one goes on to a situation. But, you know, they tell a story about, you know, if you exercise, people exercise regularly, on the average, the good news is, on the average, their life will be extended by 5 years. The bad news is those are the 5 years that they were exercising. So, so there's not necessarily a net gain in their activities. But okay. But that's right. The concept of arichut yamim is, you're correct, is I think we have to understand this, not in terms of any type of guarantee of you'll live longer, but you'll live better. That's right, that's right. Stuart, it's a wonderful life, right? You see, a person does not know the ripple effects that they put into action. It's a very religious movie because we never really realize the void that might be in the world had we not been we just don't know. And as a result, we have to be very, very careful to try to do good things because we have all sorts of impacts on people that we might be unaware of. One interesting question, just a few halakhic questions about Tibur Aviyeh. And on one end, we said kavod, it's a mitzvah to give your parents a cup of coffee, give them food, etc. The question is for it. And the Talmud discusses the economics. And interestingly enough, the Talmud says, kibud av v'ayim is not a mitzvah that requires financial expenditures. Meaning to say, there's a mitzvah to give your parents a cup of tea, but you can use their tea. You don't have to use your tea. But of course, what that emphasizes is, the mitzvah is much more the interpersonal mitzvah as opposed to throwing money. Medical care. Now, if a parent cannot afford it, there's a mitzvah, of course, but if a parent can afford appropriate medical care, it is not your obligation to spend the money, but you may have the obligation to help them arrange for the treatment. In other words, spend the time. Don't throw money at the problem, but spend the time. But ultimately, they are financially responsible. They tell the story about a young yeshiva boy in the great Volozhin Yeshiva, which was the greatest of the Lithuanian yeshivot. And he had learned this Gemara, and he went to the Rosh Yeshiva and said, I just learned that for honoring my parents, I don't have to spend my own money. So my parents want me to come home for Pesach, but they didn't send me money for the trip. So I guess this means I don't have to go, right? So the Rosh Yeshiva said, no, it just means you got to start walking. So you don't have to spend the money, but if you want to take a train instead of walking, then you know that's your decision. That's not that. So that's one aspect of it. And the Talmud gives a striking illustration of how money is not the real way you honor your parents. The Talmud says there was a son who gave his father the finest pheasants, and that son will go to hell. And there's another that made his father pull a millstone, and that son will go to heaven. And it gave the example that a rich kid was taking care of his father, gave his father pheasants, and his father said, kind of said, as sometimes parents say, you know, can you really afford this type of thing? And the son said to his father this remark. He said, you know, when I give this to the dogs, they don't say anything, so I wish, you know, you could keep quiet too. The Talmud says the pheasant doesn't mean anything. This is a worthless thing. On the other hand, the other example the Talmud gives was a situation where in order for the father to feel productive, he actually put the father to hard labor. And the Talmud says, in such a situation, that's a tremendous mitzvah as well. So the issue is not money, and the issue is not material comforts. The issue is, give parents a sense of dignity, a sense of importance. And the issue of parents in nursing homes is a very, very difficult issue. I don't have time to comprehensively address it in this forum. Suffice it to say that halakha does recognize, as you would expect, that there are times when an out-of-house placement might be the only option. But even then, it's necessary to take steps to protect not only a parent's physical and medical needs, but their dignity and their sense of respect and whatever sense of control over their lives they could have. That is what really Kibud Abayim is, to give them a sense of being significant and being important. And one of the great curses, really, of old age is not merely the physical infirmities that may come, but the sense of a person not mattering anymore. And that is what kills a person. And that is why even things like a pet or a plant, even a plant, are so useful in geriatric treatment, because it gives people a reason to live. It gives people a reason that they're needed. But if one has children, wouldn't it be nice if that would come from the children and not just from the roses? You know, sometimes we need the surrogates, as it were. But ideally, this is the highest mitzvah of Kibud Abayim, is to give parents a sense that they are needed. You know, the old Yiddish saying, famous Yiddish saying, 10 children, one parent can take care of 10 children, 10 children cannot take care of a parent. You know, unfortunately, it often is very true. Yeah.
And just by extension, this is even a mitzvah, I know it shows up elsewhere, extend that to in-laws, grandparents.
Very, very interesting. The Talmud does say that it does extend to in-laws. So a person is supposed to honor their mother-in-law, their father-in-law, etc. It does extend.
Same parameters, right? Exactly.
Well, yes, subject to one exception I'll mention in a moment. Same parameters, basically. This does extend to grandparents. But interestingly enough, one's obligations to their parents override one's obligations to their grandparents, which creates an interesting paradox. Let me give you a very simple example, just like a prosaic example. Let's assume that your parents are visiting you. Right? So you have kids, right? So you have now three generations, grandparents, parents, kids. So question is, and the kids are bringing food in from the kitchen. Who are the kids supposed to serve first? Grandparents or parents? So in the pure halakhic paradigm, the children are supposed to serve the parent first, and the parent are then supposed to pass the food to their parent. That is how it's supposed to be. Huh? Right. And then the parent gives it to their parents as a sign of respect. That's the way it should be. And it's important because kids need to know that the parents, you know, one of the common frictions in families is when in-laws or grandparents, as it were, override or contradict what parents are trying to do, and it's very important that they don't have that input. As the old saying goes, if you want to be asked for advice, be sure never to give it. You know, that's the old.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's real helpful. I, yeah. Not that. The one before. On Shabbat, I usually have my mother-in-law coming to visit, and my mother lives with us.
Right.
And I always serve my mother first,
because
I do that, and I never knew that I was required.
Oh, no. You absolutely
that's
should serve your mother first.
And your husband can serve his mother at the same time.
Oh, he's busy cooking in the kitchen.
Okay.
It raises an interesting question, though. If you're using that example, if in fact your mother lives with you and your mother-in-law does, and let's assume they're similar ages,
they are.
In a way, one would almost have more upmanas in that situation for the mother-in-law because she doesn't have the opportunity to live with you all the time. You serve your mother all the time. So unless you mother really needs it, it's not happening. You know, you want to give them a greater promotion.
Well, you know, after a while you develop the concept of simultaneous service. You know, you try to figure it out that way. You know. Right. Now, there is, however, a very interesting rule that Maimonides codifies, which is important for people to know, and that is Maimonides recognizes in-law frictions. And Maimonides says, as a rule, and this is in the Shulchan Aruch as well, that a husband has the right to tell his wife, I don't want your parents coming to my house. And a wife, I hasten to add, has the right to tell her husband, I cannot live with your parents coming to my house. However, Maimonides makes this very important point. Husband cannot stop wife from seeing her parents. Meaning to say, husband has the right to say that in my home, this makes me extremely uncomfortable, but he does not have the right to tell his wife, and vice versa. It goes both ways. I don't want you to have contact. So there is a recognition here that frictions can be very, very difficult, and the home is regarded as a certain castle, as it were, in which a person is entitled to be freed of what they regard as noxious or toxic influences. Even then, though, I want to emphasize that this is within the paradigm of respect to the extent that it's possible, meaning you kind of indicate, just too hard for me, but you don't turn it into yelling and screaming and insulting, like it would be totally improper for a husband to tell his wife, you know, your parents are just idiots and I can't stand them. That's not the way you do it. Rather, you just say, I have certain difficulties and I'm just very, very uncomfortable, etc. I mean, you do it in that particular way. So, there is a balance here. Now, interestingly enough, Halacha didn't seem to assume that you could exclude your own parents from your house. In other words, the issue seemed to have been, you tell your wife you don't want her parents, or she says she doesn't want your parents. What if she says, I don't want her parents? Halacha does not explicitly deal with that problem. I guess the assumption was that was a likely scenario, but unfortunately today, sometimes people get along much better with their in-laws than with their parents. And so you'd have a similar issue at that point. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's common.
Yeah.
Too many.
No, it's fine.
But the thing that I wanted to share that I find very helpful with this framework is that it's a relief to have this framework, having grown up in a culture that puts such ultimate validity in emotion.
Right.
So how can I treat somebody respectfully or kindly if I'm carrying around all this anger and other baggage?
Mm-hmm.
But if I kind of have the excuse, the psychological excuse, it doesn't matter that they made it wrong here, I might be carrying these grudges, but that I know how to treat them in order to be treating them with respect. Becomes so much easier. You can kind of distance yourself, and that ultimately what happens is what you do, and then you feel.
And again, that goes back to Na'aseh v'nishma.
Right.
We do first. You know, because if you wait until the feelings are transformed, those transformations often never occur. And a person can have a tremendous amount of, I consider this even a form of legitimate pride. You know, we talk about pride as a bad thing. You know, that's true. Pride, arrogance. But I think a person can have legitimate pride that they behaved in a good and decent way, even if their feelings inside were totally the other way. And a person can look themselves in the mirror and say, you know, I did a good thing today.
As you know, I came to Judaism from a background in the theater, and I think it's interesting that in theater there is a psychological theory, James Lang, which is quoted, which is exactly this thing of doing, and then the feeling will be generated,
and
teach actors to act by doing it first.
Now, is that the opposite of the method acting? Metanaching is to kind of get yourself into the feeling?
You do the act.
That also talks about doing it.
Yeah, and then the feelings do come and are generated. You might want to find a situation where that feeling will be aroused, but you concentrate on the actual action, not on the feeling.
And like Shakespeare said, all the world is a play. So in effect, we are doing this play of life.
That's funny.
Yeah. Okay, that's a very good question. Yeah, take care. The question was step-parents. Yes, you are obligated to honor a step-parent, but only as long as they are the partner of your natural parent. Meaning to say, if one's mother remarried, there's a mitzvah to honor her husband, but only as long as the mother is alive. In other words, it's via the connection to the biological parent. Now, there is, of course, a mitzvah to honor parents, even after death. That's why, for example, the custom among so many Jews is to name a child after a parent. There's interesting halachot that you're not supposed to refer to your parents by their first name. And it's disrespectful. I mean, sometimes we have in modern society, we call them Bob or Mary or whatever it is. But this is why, even when you name a child after a parent, why we have these Yiddish diminutives, Bobola literally means little grandmother. Mamala, little mommy. Tatala, little father. Because it was such an ingrained custom that you didn't call even your child by the name of your parents, that you call them little father. It's a beautiful thing. So every time, you know. And now today we use these indiscriminately. Everybody's a mamala, tatala, bibla, but these have precise terms. These were actually, if somebody was named after your mother, you would call them mamala, little mother. If somebody was named after your grandmother, they were called bibla. If somebody was named after your father, they'd be called tatala. Right? That is where the Yiddish thing comes from. Even today, in many circles, people will not marry spouses that have the same name as their parents. This is not always followed, but some people are very strict about it. Some people, if their mother's name is Sarah, they will not marry a woman whose name is Sarah. Or if their father's name is Moshe, they will not marry a husband whose name is Moshe. Yes, they have a different tradition than that. But part of this is so you won't kind of be using your parents' name, where people might think you're talking about your parents instead of your spouse. The other reason is a little bit more bizarre. The other reason is a little strange. The other reason is given that since extended families used to live under the same roof, there was a fear in terms of marital relations. When you call for Sarah, you may get the wrong Sarah kind of thing. So a fear of that, but I think that probably the main reason was, again, assuming everyone's living under the same roof, when you call Sarah, people shouldn't think that you're calling your mother by that name. Okay, so that is a little bit of my comments on kibud aviyim, honoring parents, reverence of parents, and the like. Yeah.
But if you have,
All right.
Question.
Yeah. Okay, excellent question. What if there's a conflict between parents and spouses? This is, of course, a major, major issue that we face today. Generally speaking, a marriage is considered to be the primary relationship in a person's life. This goes back to Genesis. What does Genesis say? Al ken, therefore, shall a person forsake his father and mother and cleave unto his wife. Now, obviously, the Torah does not mean forsake father and mother. You don't forsake your father and mother. But what this intimates is that in the event of a conflict that cannot be resolved amicably between husband and wife versus parental wishes, one has to foster shalom bayit first. A very, very simple example would be, let's assume your parents are absolutely against your marriage. Is there any mitzvah to either listen to them? The answer is no. Now, that doesn't mean you can't take into account. If they have some concerns, you can take that into account. We don't mean dismiss it, But if you're convinced that this is the right marriage for you, you go with that. Now, I'm reluctant to say this because I think sometimes we jump to a conclusion too quickly. Meaning to say, you do have to try to explore all avenues in which you could honor your parents as well, as opposed to writing them off. But if it really reaches a point in which it's either your marriage or your parents, you do have to choose your marriage, and that would seem to be the decision that, you make under those circumstances. But you try to work things out. You try to create an atmosphere of kavod, and even if you reject your parental input, you still do so in a respectful and loving way. Okay. The next ones are very staccato, that's lo tirzach, don't murder. As you know, this should not be translated don't kill, because sometimes you're supposed to kill. People are executed for various other roads. You're allowed to kill in self-defense. The word for kill is harog, to harog. Murder, however, refers to premeditated desire to take life without any justification. That's ritzicha. I should mention, too, that in rabbinic tradition, certain activities of behavior are tantamount to murder. For example, humiliating somebody publicly is a form of murder. It is character assassination. So when we talk about don't murder, we're referring to that type of stuff as well. Lo tinach, do not commit adultery, that is respect to the marital relationship. All of us know, however, that, again, this is a little bit difficult to explain and fully justify. I'm not going to try to justify it, but just to lay out the basic framework. As you know, there is a fundamental difference between the definitions of adultery as it applies to a man and as it applies to the woman. Meaning, if a married man has affairs with single women, all of them are principal, and his wife has grounds for an immediate divorce, death. But that is technically not a violation of this commandment. And the reason is, since the Torah permits polygamy, the Torah permits marrying multiple women, it's marriage, yes, but in terms of adultery, you can't say that somehow you're being unfaithful to wife number one by being with woman number two, because you would be allowed to marry woman number two under that original thing. Now, it is true that since the 11th century, there was a rabbi, Rabbeinu Gershom, polygamy has been a banned practice among Ashkenazic Jews, although not among Sephardic. Sephardic is fairly recent, but they've stopped doing it. But that still does not make it biblical adultery on the level of this commandment. It's reprehensible, it's disgusting, it deserves the fullest condemnation and denigration, but it is not biblical adultery. And the result of that is, the child that they have from such a union would not have the stigma of being a mamzer, and therefore such a child is allowed to marry into the Jewish people. On the other hand, if a married woman has an adulterous union with either a married man or an unmarried man, it makes no difference. If it's a married woman, then both parties are guilty of biblical adultery. If it was intentional as opposed to rape, if it was intentional adultery, husband must divorce wife. He's not even permitted to forgive it, although there's a lot of complications there, if it can be proven. And the third consequence is, of course, the child is what we call a mamzer, who has very severe disabilities. Now, this notion, though, of the husband not being able to forgive is very, very tricky, because it all depends on how do you establish that adultery occurred. Let's assume wife goes over to the husband and says, I committed adultery. It's not clear that husband is obligated to believe that statement, so there might be forgiveness based on the laws of evidence that apply. But if you have two witnesses, which is rare, but if you have two witnesses to actual physical intercourse, then theoretically they would have to be apart. Now, the Satmar Rebbe, who is known probably for his anti-Zionist stance more than other areas, the Satmar Rebbe actually issued a psak halacha around 40 years ago, that if a married woman is impregnated with sperm from a sperm bank, he treated that as the commission of adultery, and he considered the child to be a mamzer. This was a very controversial decision. Rav Moshe Feinstein disagreed. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, adultery requires more than impregnation of sperm, but it is physical sexual intercourse. So that was a machloket about how far adultery goes. Yeah.
Well, in reality, if it happens that a man has an affair with a single woman and he's married, of course,
yes.
How easy is it for his wife to get?
Well, let's put it this way.
Because he has so many problems without the nose, he has a serious problem. I don't know if this will get into it.
Well, let's put it this way. Under Jewish law, she is entitled to a get.
Right.
That's fine. Now, I agree with you 100% that that doesn't mean she's going to get it. Because remember, the way Jewish law works in this area, like I have a whole book on this, the way Jewish law works in this area is a Beit Din can order, see, the Beit Din does not dissolve a marriage. The Beit Din can order the man to give a get. What happens if he says no? Now, in the state of Israel, where the Beit Din is part of the court structure, a Beit Din can actually have a person sentenced to jail if he does not give a get. And even that doesn't always work. There was a fellow who was in jail for 30 years who died last year. But in America, the situation is even worse. A Beit Din, three eminent rabbis, orders a man to give a get. He says no. Well, what's the next step? What happens after that point?
No enforcement.
There really is no next step. There are things synagogues can do, you know, and synagogues can deny the person membership, deny a person honors. There's certain informal pressure. Sometimes they post his name on billboards. The Jewish press in New York publishes the names of men who refuse to give a get to their wives. But number one, when you have a lot of synagogues in a community, there tends to be, you know, husband has his places where people support him, wife has her places. So he'll just go to the shul across the street, you know. There's no unity in this matter. And number two, sometimes the kind of aggressive denigration backfires. In other words, sometimes you have to try to convince people with gentility. So it's a very difficult psychological way of how to deal with these husbands. Now, in New York State, there are two laws on the books that protect these women that we do not have in Maryland. One law says that the man would be unable to get a civil divorce unless he gives his wife a get. So if he wants to get a civil divorce, he has to give her a get. And there's a more recent law that says that a court may create a double tier of alimony. And the court might say, your alimony obligation is $500 per week until you give a get, and $250 per week thereafter. So that creates a big incentive on him to give the get, because he can reduce his obligations. So those are two laws in New York which can back up a Beit Din. Paradoxically, I can't go into this now, but paradoxically, there are halachic scholars that feel that the New York laws are improper because they allow the court system to directly get involved bypassing the Beit Din. So ironically, some people halachically feel these should be repealed.
But you know, this is a very serious problem. I mean, I know someone that I know who has this problem. And a very serious problem. Isn't there a way that maybe it needs to be reinterpreted?
Well, people are working on it. There are prenuptial agreements now that are used in many Orthodox and conservative marriages where you sign up front that you agree in the case of marital dissolution to go to a Beit Din and abide by their decision. Now, let me explain why that's useful. The reason that's useful is because that becomes, from a secular perspective, an agreement to arbitrate. Now, if you've signed such an agreement and a Beit Din orders you to give a get, it's not just they ordered you, but now the other party can go to court and enforce the terms of an arbitration. So the prenuptial agreement is useful because it will allow the decision of a Beit Din to be enforced by a secular court that can tell the husband, you give a get or you go to jail, because that's how an arbitration decree can be enforced. Even then, you may still have the guy in Israel who will be in jail, but at least it gives that extra thing. So prenuptial agreements is one possibility. Now, there is a rogue, is the best word, there is a rogue Beit Din operating in New York that is experimenting with the concept of marital annulments. which is very, very specious and very, very questionable.
That's
well, yeah, that's right. That's right. They're working with the theory that, gee, had I known that the guy I married would turn out to be so abusive, I never would have married him, therefore the marriage is fraud, therefore I don't need a get. They're expanding the concept of annulments, but I have to say this is a rogue baked in, because at least within the Orthodox tradition, the basis for annulment is extremely narrow. And to allow women to marry without a get, although I understand their motives might be laudable, is creating the potential for mamzerut, and in particular, it's not going to be recognized by any other Orthodox community. So this is not one of those things where one guy can just come up with a theory unless it's accepted by other people. So the only thing we've come up with really is we've come up with prenuptial agreements, and in the state of Israel, we have the New York legislation, and in the state of Israel, they have some interesting legislation, such as, they can't do it in America, they're not going to renew it. If the man didn't give a get after a Beit Din ordered him to do so, his driver's license won't be renewed. There are various licensing controls they can have. When he applies for a driver's license or some type of permit, they can hold up the permit until he gives the get, which is very interesting. But that doesn't work in America because of separation of church and state, which we don't have in Israel. Yeah.
Now, what about the concept that the man has to willingly give a get? And here you have secular courts ordering, the state of New York ordering this kind
right.
of thing.
Well, you've identified exactly what the halachic problem is. And that is, when a Beit Din orders you to give a get, then coercion is allowed to enforce the decision of a Beit Din. But when all you have is a secular court ordering you to give a get without the Beit Din being involved, that is called a coerced get, and it's invalid. And one of the arguments against the New York law is that the get that it coerces out of the husband by telling the husband, you're going to pay $500 until you give a get, is a coerced get. That's exactly the halachic issue of why the get may be invalid. Okay. All right, so that's a little bit, again, this is far afield, but that kind of addresses the idea of adultery. I should keep in mind as well that, remember when Jimmy Carter made that statement that he lusts in his heart, that halakha, to whatever degree is humanly possible, and things are not always humanly possible in that sense, tries to prevent the lusting of the heart as well. There are various practices regarding not getting involved in pornography, in books or films, even though it's innocuous, you might say it's victimless activity, but nevertheless creates certain fantasies that may detract from the relationship of husband and wife. So this does include within the if, we include pornography and the like, and indeed even things like masturbation are considered to be forms of adultery and the like, which are normally not countenanced. Lo tignov, do not steal. Now here's a great, I don't want to call it trivial pursuit because it's not trivial, but it's a little fact, a little known fact about the Ten Commandments. It says, thou shalt not steal. So most people interpret this as the prohibition against robbery, burglary, or embezzlement. Actually not. Rashi says, this is a prohibition against kidnapping. Thou shalt not steal does not refer to gonev mammon. Those are other verses in Leviticus, which talk about not stealing, but it refers to gonev nefashot, stealing human beings, kidnapping. And how do we know this? Rashi says, because everything else on the list is a capital crime. Murder, adultery, these are capital offenses. But we know that stealing property is not a capital offense. So, based on the principle that you interpret the words in the context in which they appear, lo tignov is actually gonev nefashot, kidnapping is considered to be a capital crime, as opposed to gonev stealing money. Okay, but be it as it may, the word geneva as a word for theft, there are two words used for theft in the Torah. There is gezeira, which is robbery, and the robber is called gazlan, and there is geneva, and the thief is called ganav. Now, leaving apart the kidnapping aspect here, but even in property, the gazlan is the robber, and the ganap is the burglar that breaks into your house. Interestingly enough, what are the punishments? This doesn't deal with punishments, but what are the sentences for ganap and gazlan? Well, the ganav is obligated to make 100% restitution. By that I mean, if I stole $100, I have to pay $200. In other words, the object plus its value. Okay, that's called kefel. Kefel is double. The hachpil, to double. And it can even go further. If I steal a cow or a bull and I slaughter it or I sell it, I actually have to pay five times. In other words, if the bull is worth $100, I got to pay $500. If it's a sheep and I do the same, I got to pay $400. Now that is a rule for a ganav. What if I'm an armed robber and I steal the same object? An armed robber only has to pay the value of the object itself. The armed robber does not have the penalty of kefel or 4 and 5. So the paradox is, why is armed robbery less of a crime than burglary? Right? In any modern secular code, armed robbery is a much more serious offense than burglary. And the Talmud gives the following intriguing answer. He says, the gazlan is willing to do his act openly and brazenly. He does not fear man more than he fears God. He puts man and God on the same footing, so he makes restitution. The ganav is afraid of human beings. The ganav is afraid of being caught. He puts man on a higher footing than God. He's not afraid that God sees him. He's not afraid that God is watching. And therefore, he is punished more severely because he denigrates the honor of God by being fearful of his actions vis-a-vis other human beings and not fearful of his actions vis-a-vis God. The gazlan has no respect for anybody, as it were. So that's a paradox in the halakha. Okay. What time do you have? Okay. I have no idea.
No, I have to. Well, I know. We have a day, March
11th, next day. Yeah, we've missed several sessions, though. At least three, I think.
March 11th was first.
No, it goes through. I have it, March 18th. Yes.
When
the
show
is
scheduled,
the day of court.
I don't know. I'll get back to that. Now we do have a class next week, right?
Yeah.
Okay.